This is CliffCentral.com.
She's waltzed at dawn with a Chinese dance instructor in a Beijing square, fallen over emperor penguins in Antarctica, lunched with a Raja in Rajasthan, dined with the comrades in Cuba, been winched over a raging torrent 9,000 foot up in the Andes in Peru. She's climbed Ayers Rock in the red heart of Australia, broken bread with monks in Tibet's oldest monastery, down thumbs of pepper vodka in Russia, confronted Afar warriors armed with Kalashnikovs in Ethiopia's Rift Valley, shivered at Everest base camp in Tibet, eyeballed blue-footed boobies in the Galapagos Islands, and heard the stars sing in the Kalahari, and plenty more. She's also my Aunt Kate Turkington.
And I caught a tiger fish in the Jozini Dam last week.
I was going to
2.2 kilos.
Who knew you were such a fisherwoman?
I'm not. But the Turkington luck. If I'm in a place, I've caught tiger fish on the Zambezi before. I've been to the Jozini Dam, wonderful houseboat, Shimanzi houseboat. Very laid back, not zhuzh, really nice people, comfort food. And it was a desperately hot afternoon. It was about a week ago in late November. And I said, I'm too hot to go out on the boat. I'm going to lie in my cabin and cool off. Anyway, I couldn't sleep. It was too hot. So I went out and they'd all gone out. There were four big Afrikaners, including the forward lock of the Blue Bulls, asked me about rugby. I know all about how corrupt or not it is. Anyway, they all went off. So one of the other guys, there was another little boat, he said, shall we go and catch up with them? I said, you know, I'm too hot. He said, I'll tell you what, we'll just throw you a line over the side of the boat. Line. This 2.2 tiger fish came and took it. And of course, the blokes came back. The four blokes came back. Nothing. Nothing.
And you were holding up. You were holding up.
I was going, wah, 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 wah.
Catch of the day.
Absolutely.
Well, there's so much that I want to catch up with you about because the last time we spoke, I arrived late.
You did. And you're never late.
I'm
I
never
must
late.
Say, you are, like me, you're a very punctual person.
And not by way of excuse, but explanation. I think I was just worked to the bone at that point, and I wasn't getting enough sleep. And I think
you must,
I'd also
you must get sleep.
In my head, yeah. Well, you're going to teach me some of these things, but in my head, I'd thought, God, I can't be late for Kate Turkington. And when you do that, you inevitably end up being late.
Yeah. Do you know you have to have sleep? I think one of the secrets of my success is my, I've never had a memory for names. You know that I have a lousy memory for names, but I have a superb memory for anything else. I can remember back to 3 years, 2 years, but I do need 8 hours sleep a night. If I don't, I'm like the proverbial dormouse. I curl up in a nest of pillows and take a sleeping pill.
Oh, do you?
Well, you know, given my...
Absolutely.
You know, my problem is, Gareth, I can't get to sleep because my mind races. And last night I thought, I'm not going to take anything. And I put the light out at 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock. My mind is still racing. And I think, bother it. Blow it.
You can say filthy, dirty words like that here if you want to. We're allowed to.
Well, I thought, fuck it. I'm going to take her. I took half a pill, got me to sleep, woke up 8 hours later.
But I think that's also why you're as vital as you are, because your brain hasn't slowed down one bit.
Not in the slightest.
You know, I was talking to someone who you'd lectured at university, and they said that you were always the most fun lecturer to attend classes of, and that they'd never walked out of your class the slightest bit bored or unstimulated.
Right.
And I think that when I was producing for you all of, 20, perhaps even 22 years ago, somewhere around
but
there.
But you were a great producer.
Well, you were a great presenter.
No, but you were.
What you taught me was that you can find in every guest there's something amazing and interesting and terrific.
Yeah.
But you can also find in your own experience ways to relate to other people, which you might not assume the first time you meet them. Yeah. And if you're not prepared to make the effort with anybody, then they won't make the effort with
but
you.
But you know what? My mother, Doris, you remember I wrote a book called Doing It with Doris, who said most things darkly. She said, you never know what goes on behind people's front doors. And my mantra, you never know what's around the next corner. And that's what I've taught my kids and my grandkids. You never know what's around the next corner. And sometimes it may not be good, the wonder of it, the promise of it. And somebody's just sent me, I still review books for City Press and write travel for City Press. Somebody sent me yesterday the little book of the Dalai Lama's sayings. Some are a bit mystical and whatever. But one of them, which isn't particularly original, I love, he said there are 2 days over which you have no control, yesterday and tomorrow. So carpe diem, seize the day. And that's what I've always done. Do it. Don't wait till you're 60 or 70 or do it. Mm. Do it. Do it.
Well, you do.
And you know, Gareth,
you said you've been to 9 countries this year. You've probably met some incredible people.
I have.
Every year you're an adventurer, right?
It's a yes. I love people and I get on with people, especially men. I love men and I get on well with them. And I think the 4 blokes who were on the fishing boat with me, they were quite stalwart Afrikaners. I don't think they'd ever quite met anybody like me. And once we got going with them, by the end of the trip, they were asking me, how did I think the country could go? How could I put the country right? Which I told them, of course, because I'm incredibly positive still.
Well, you are. So I wanted to start off because there are people who know you and there are people who've known your work over many years, books and your radio shows and your travel blogs, your writing, the experiences that you've shared with people over some years now. But there are a lot of people who don't know that you're also, I mean, you're a devoted grandmother. You've got your own children who are all doing extraordinary things.
Well, devoted grandmother, let me just edit that a bit. I have 9 grandchildren ranging from 28 to 6. 28, 26, 22, 19, 16, 12, 11, 10, and 6. And usually they say, Granny, we have to listen to the radio to find out where you are or where are you. So I'm devoted in that I tell them things their parents will never tell them.
I met one of your granddaughters the other day. She was well-mannered, and she came up to me and she said, you worked with my granny once.
Oh.
I said to her, oh, who's your granny? And she said, Kate Turkington, of course.
She probably fancied you madly.
she was very sweet.
But
and I saw that sparkle in her eye that she gets from you.
There, I went kicking and screaming to a nativity play on Saturday morning. I was asked for the 6-year-old because he was the angel Gabriel. I can remember being the angel Gabriel when I was 4 and I wanted to be Herod.
The wicked king.
Yeah. And oh, it was absolutely sweet. All the mothers had made all the gowns, but he was a bit tired. He yawned a bit. He wasn't the most charismatic angel Gabriel, shall we say. Where another of the grandsons who's 16, who's doing drama for Matric, he's got that kind of stage presence.
But I think the Turkingtons probably, all of your descendants and even of Doris's descendants, all of them probably prefer a sort of darker character to the light ones.
Definitely. Definitely.
All right, so this spirit of adventure, you have 4 of your own children too. And by the way,
they all live in Johannesburg. Now, you know, I don't believe in past lives and I don't believe in future lives. But had I had a past life, which is Irish, I must have done something right because they all live and work in Johannesburg.
So you get to see them all?
Yes, yes.
No, that is spectacular. Yeah.
And what I don't know about the lives of Johannesburg, sex lives of Johannesburg teenagers is not worth knowing because they tell granny
everything.
And I tell them things, dreadful things their parents did. And also, Gareth, this is a great joy of being a grandparent. You can't tell your kids things. You know, you can't say, don't marry him, he's awful, because they'll immediately go off and marry him. Or don't go near her. But the grandchildren, they have to bring the boyfriends and girlfriends for the Turkington seal of approval. And if they don't get it, I say, she's awful, get rid of her. You can't possibly. And they listen to you. They listen to you.
Well, they listen to you because you're not the parent.
Well, and also I have a lot of experience. I can recognise a wimp or a wuss at 100 yards.
Are you matriarchal in that respect? I mean, do they come to you not only because that you're a bit sort of left of field and slightly?
No, they come to me because I'm fun.
Yeah, but you're also a bit odd.
Thanks.
No, well,
oh, no,
in a good way. I think that
absolutely
way far better to have. I wish I had grannies when I think of you.
Totally.
I don't wish I have had grannies if I think of those bun-wearing old ladies who live in...
Well,
you know.
One of the best compliments I ever got was from one of them, you're not like the other grannies, which I do take pride in. But just while I was thinking it, I should have put it in the book, I haven't. One of the best compliments I ever got. I did the most dreadful trip to Dubai, which is the most goddamn awful place in the whole world, soulless. And I was on my own, which is not good because you need somebody to giggle with and moan with and have a whiskey with. So I had this minor scion of the noble family escorting me around, who wouldn't get into the car because there was an Indian driver, so he drove his own car. Anyway, last night, starch white robes, headdress, everything, he took me out to dinner on the creek. You know, everything's so artificial in Dubai. Anyway, no alcohol, of course. So he looks at me over the top of his lemonade, gives me a piercing gaze and says, "You're not a bit like my mother."
What a compliment.
And I think that's probably one of the best compliments I've ever had in my entire life.
Listen, congratulations also on Tara and Tiffany. And they just won an award.
Two awards.
The Seattle... They went off to receive the International Women's Entrepreneurial Challenge Foundation Award, and they were recently featured in the Mail and Guardian.
Their top book. 50 women, 2017 women, and I had to laugh because the subtitle of the book is On the Shoulders of Giants, so that we've really given them a hard time on that. No, I'm very, very proud of them because they believe in South Africa. They're B1 company. I mean, they have about 70 staff. They've given opportunities to people who would never have had an opportunity. And some of them have made it and some of them haven't. They don't take prisoners. If somebody doesn't, you know, make the grade, they...
Yeah, it's not a charity.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And they won, I think it was 10 awards in the the New Generation Awards, which was really super because, you know, some of the agencies, or they don't call themselves an agency, they call themselves a communications company, make entries especially for awards. They don't. They put in 10 entries and 9 of their clients got awards.
That's terrific. So
which is, but also they don't take prisoners. But I try and take one of them each year to with me traveling. Tara and I were in Morocco last year. Tiffany and I were in Croatia this year. Don't go to Croatia.
Really?
It is.
Everybody else is telling me to go to Croatia.
It is the most beautiful country. It has the most lovely people. The food is great. The scenery is wonderful. But I'm going to give you a new word. Nomophobia. Fear of tourists.
Oh.
Hundreds of thousands of tourists.
Impossible.
And I'm not exaggerating. We were in Dubrovnik. I'm a Game of Thrones addict.
Oh, are you?
Oh, yes, of course. And the size of the old town of Dubrovnik, think maybe 2 Santon cities. I don't know. Not very big.
Mm-hmm.
There was people gridlock. We could not move forward, backwards, sideways. You could not move for people. It was horrible, horrible. We actually got up and went in at dawn finally. There were still a lot of people. And our guides told us, you know, they're killing the goose that lays the golden egg because they're letting in hundreds of thousands of people. It's going to ruin the ancient monuments.
Because what, 10 years ago, no one really knew Croatia even existed. You know,
it's flavour of the month now.
Sure.
And also comparatively affordable for Europeans. It's still regarded as a cheap destination for Europeans.
So now it's just flooded.
And the thing is, you can't go off-season because they've just extended the season from the beginning of April to the end of October. Then it's the middle of bloody winter and everything shuts down. Beautiful, beautiful, but I'd never go back. Oh, but I must tell you, 2 things happened while we were there. made the headlines. One, we got caught in a cyclone, which was the first
Mediterranean cyclone.
And I was on the prowl.
I got a WhatsApp video from you of you struggling to hold on a ship.
No life vest, yeah. No nothing.
You could have gone overboard.
Anywhere, easily, but rather that and die in an old age home in Benoni. Anyway, I survived that. But now here's something to think. Abramovich's yacht was in harbour. Now, Abramovich owns Chelsea Football Club.
Right.
Third richest man in the world.
Russian oligarch.
Yeah, and yeah. I don't know if he's in with Putin or
not. Oh, he must be in, otherwise he would have had all
anyway,
that taken away.
Anyway, the yacht is there.
Yeah. Enormous.
Just let me tell you about it. It's the third biggest yacht in the world. It has three helicopters on the roof, a missile detection system, and a submarine. And it only takes 24 guests. There are 68 staff. And the Croatian papers were, because we followed all the local stuff, we had very mixed feelings because it put in, just to refuel, it took on €1 million of fuel that was going to last for, wait for it, 40 hours.
You're joking.
And half of Croatia was saying, great for the economy. The others were saying, Get out. We don't want you. We don't want you here. So what's the point, Gareth, of having all that money if you're living your life in fear? Three submarines, a missile detection system, three helicopters.
Yeah, it's no way to live.
For God's sake. And horrible. All right. Like a battleship.
Part of why I love having you around me, and we've had lunches and breakfasts, I consider myself very privileged to be able to impinge on your time
Thank
as
you,
I
so
do.
You should.
But yes, absolutely. I remember we had a conversation about sort of this crass materialism that we see around us too.
Yeah.
When you look at Abramovich's yacht, there's not an ounce of jealousy in you when you see it.
No, not in the slightest.
There's so many people in this world who are hungry for material things. We saw this Black Friday sale on Friday.
Now, shocking.
Now, what is for you a more worthy pursuit than money?
I'll tell
money?
You exactly. And I've said this to you before, I'm sure. And I have, it's not because I've grown old. I've always believed this. You can take things away from people, but you can't take memories and experiences. Nobody can take those from you. I have no money. I have a pension. I do have a house. I have a car. I have two rescue Jack Russell dogs, and I earn money from travel writing, media training, whatever. I have enough, and I don't want. And I have a wonderful family and
so
friends.
So you wouldn't want to be Sophia Loren. You wouldn't want to be some minor royal.
Oh, God, no. I was in one of the chapters in my new book is called I Don't Want to Die in St. Moritz, because I nearly died in St. Moritz. Another bloody awful place. I'm sorry, everybody thinks it's wonderful.
Well,
all
this is
the glitterati.
This is the most
all
amazing.
The glitterati and the jet
It's
set.
Even in the song, Where Do You Go to My Lovely?
Yes.
You go, and when the snow falls, you find what found in St. Moritz with the others of the jet set.
And she sips her
Napoleon brandy and you never get her lips wet. So how do you do that, first of all? Can you sip Napoleon brandy and not get your lips wet?
Because she's just pretending to, presumably. Either that or she's chucking it down. But it's a beautiful place. It's one of the oldest, most exclusive ski resorts in Switzerland. And Switzerland, for me, it's a beautiful country, but it's too chocolate box and too tidy. All the cows munch in unison. All the flowers grow the same way in the flower boxes. Even the dogs on the mountains have little rubber boots. I mean, hello. Everybody has hiking poles. Anyway, the chapter was, I don't want to die in St. Moritz, because I thought I was going to die in St. Moritz. I was nowhere near dying. But we were there, I don't know, I think about October, with a lovely, lovely press group, good friends. And the main drag is just full of label shops, Gucci, Prada, every possible. And empty, totally empty. So I said to our guide, who buys all this stuff? He said, the Russians come in mid-November, they go out mid-January, and it's like the quillias or the locusts, they come in, whoosh, they buy everything and they're out.
And the rest of the year, the shops are fallow.
Yeah.
Madness. and San Moritz is obviously also full of those plastic people.
Totally. I mean, you know, maybe I'm being judgmental. Then I say to my family, I've earned the right to be judgmental. One of them once said to me, I may have told you this before. One of them once said to me when she was a teenager, the trouble with you, Mum, is you only like beautiful, intelligent people. And I thought for a bit and I said, yeah, I don't like ugly, stupid people. And if that makes me judgmental.
Is it okay if you're ugly but you're intelligent, or if you're stupid but beautiful?
Because ugliness is not physical.
Ugliness
isn't. You know, one of the sexiest, most gorgeous men I ever met was the writer of the Wimpole of the barrister, the English barrister, who wrote the, I told you I was bad at names, the legal series. Can't remember the name. He was in his 70s. He looked a bit like a frog. He had a limp. The power of that man's mind. Rumpole of the Bailey.
John, oh, yes. Rumpole of the Bailey.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. The author. Absolutely.
John Mortimer.
Yes, yeah. John Mortimer. Absolutely stunning. And you just listen to every word. And, you know, I thought of you recently because I was replaying. I kept some of my tapes from Believe It or Not, not all, alas, but I did keep the Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion one, and I was replaying it and thinking to myself how anybody listening to him, he is so succinct, so intelligent.
Erudite.
He has such a way with words. I mean, he should have won a Nobel Prize for literature.
Yes.
I've reviewed his new book, which is called Science and the Soul, and he's deliberately put science and soul, juxtaposed them together. And he's gone over some of his old stuff and changed his mind, not in the main things, but changed his mind.
Well, he was quite strident at a point.
Yes.
And I think, you know, a lot of us, I find I've also adapted to be less abrasive about what I think and be more accepting about what other people think.
But I still
I give you credit here too. You taught me a lot about that. And I keep referencing the title of your second or third book. Was it your second? With There's More to Life Than Surface.
Yeah. He makes the point that, and it's quite interesting, so I'm going to come back to the Dalai Lama's new little book. Richard Dawkins hasn't changed his mind over, you cannot call a child a Christian child, a Muslim child, a Jewish child. It's ridiculous. You don't call a child a communist child or a socialist child or an ANC child. They are the children of whatever, communists or Christians or whatever. And he says that's a form of child abuse. And just reading the Dalai Lama's little book yesterday, he makes a very cogent point. He said, there are all sorts of religions. We must be tolerant and people must choose from their own spiritual. He didn't use the word supermarket, but he used a word like that, that you choose.
The marketplace of ideas.
Yes, you absolutely choose what you believe. And that's a great privilege to be able to choose.
But you were going to make a point about listening to the old tape of Believe It or Not and Dawkins and what he was saying.
Well, he was saying this about children and making the point that you mustn't force ideas on somebody. And I think one of my granddaughters, when she was about 9, she just first year at Stellenbosch now. We've been very brave. I mean, this is the second Turkington now to go to Roynick to go to an Africa.
Wow.
Loving it, I may say.
I'll bet.
Loving it. When she was about 9, she said to me, I've got a problem, Granny. So I said, what is it? She said, my teacher said Adam and Eve are real, and my mum says it's a load of nonsense. So I said, but isn't that wonderful, Emily? Because you're getting two points of view, and as you grow up, you will hear more points of view, and then one day you will make up your mind what you choose to believe. And she was perfectly happy with that.
What a fantastic thing to say to a child.
Yeah.
Because you're not limiting their imagination.
No.
Or their ability to reason.
No.
You're giving them full confidence that they will figure it out for themselves
Absolutely.
In time, which also empowers them.
Exactly.
Everyone
exactly.
else seems to be telling children the opposite at the moment. They're telling children, here's a safe space where you don't get ideas into your head that are unwelcome, or go out into the world and I hope you make as many mistakes as possible, which is cruel.
Yeah.
Somewhere in between is what you said.
I think it's and giving children values. Too, I think it's incredibly important that you. I remember once we were talking about a family we knew, and I was sort of more or less saying they were deathly dull, and one of my daughters said, "You know, the important thing, Mum, is they have the same values as us. Pause. They just don't have the same personalities." But we get the Turkington seal of approval with the boyfriends and the girlfriends and the husbands and whatever that come in.
Now, we're saying Turkington seal of approval, but I need to ask you something about your husband, Alan.
Yes.
Whom I remember very well. And
he adored you.
He was a terrific, terrific man.
He adored you.
I remember being at his memorial service and he gave me the...
It was a wake. It wasn't a memorial service.
Yes, absolutely.
It was a wake.
I apologize. What it did for me was it gave me a completely positive outlook on how you can leave the world and there needn't be misery.
No, absolutely.
And there needn't be, all this ritual and sadness and morbidity.
Beating of breasts and wailing and moaning.
It was the happiest farewell I've ever attended.
Wonderful party. Yeah. In fact, one of the, I don't know if the word is still in use now, but I think one of my later producers said to me, I didn't know honkies could have parties like this. Is honky still is it a pejorative
honky's
word
fine,
now?
Whites, mlungus, whatever you want to call
it. But you know, I talk about my grandchildren with death. The 10-year-old said to me recently, I don't like the idea of people dying. I said, Rex, everybody dies. You're going to die one day. I'm going to die. It doesn't actually matter. It's what you do now where you're alive. And then I said to him, you know, Granny will never die for you because you will remember us having this conversation. You'll remember us going to the bush together. And they're so cool. And then, of course, they're fighting over which pictures of mine they're going to
The reason I reference Alan is because I think he did you a tremendous favor in some ways. And I don't know if I'm even in a position to tell you this or whether you haven't thought of it yourself and perhaps you can shed some light on it. But Alan sort of exited stage left and said, right, Kate, you can now be the adventurer.
Yeah.
You're no longer, you've got your family, but you're not shackled to them. They're all running their own lives. They're doing their own thing. And while they look to you a lot of the time, I would imagine, you don't feel that you have to be anchored down here.
No way.
Or looking after an old man.
No way.
Right. An old man is a horrible thing to be burdened with if you're a woman who has an adventurous spirit.
Last week I did a 1440km road trip and I went up to Walkerson's Country Hotel in Dalstrom.
Beautiful.
And the young general manager came to talk to me. He said, you don't remember me, do you? I said, I remember you very well. I said, I don't remember your name, but I spent a night with you at Sandibi Camp in the Okavango, and I said, you're too young to be doing this anymore. Get out and travel the world. She did. She resigned the next day. She went traveling for 2 years and is now GM of Walkerson. She said, I can't believe here you are, but I followed your advice. So, you know, and I think it's changing now, Gareth, but women of my generation, particularly South African women, were shackled to husbands and thinking they should do the right thing and support the husbands. It's what
And put everyone else first. And while I don't by any means insinuate that you're being selfish, but you do live this incredibly fulfilling, busy, interesting, stimulating life, which I feel so many women aren't able to grasp for themselves.
But they must do.
I agree.
They must do. You've only got one life.
But this is in some way why you're so exceptional, because a lot of women don't get the chance. They feel that they might be doing something wrong if they live a little.
You know, I'll give you an example. I was brought up, and I've told the story before, I was brought up during World War II, and here are Hitler's armies massing on the shores of Europe. My mother, Doris, would take my sister and I into the garden and say, there's the moon. If you want to go to the moon, go to the moon. My best friend here in South Africa was brought up by a loving, wonderful aunt and uncle because she was an orphan. But their mantra was, don't use the sewing machine because the needle might go through your finger. So you see, it was
two different ways.
I went off to France when I was 14 to a family I'd never heard of, met at the Gare du Nord by a man I didn't know. I don't think you could do it. Now, I got proposed to on a beach by a foreign legionnaire with sapphire blue eyes. My sister said, look, he's been in the desert for 3 years. He proposed to anything. I was 18 years. Oh, but I'm going to tell you one story. I'm going to tell you one story, which is in the book, and it's just a bit of a teaser. I don't keep stuff, but I have kept love letters. And I kept both love letters from both the husbands. Then I kept, when I was going through my things for the book, I found a packet of 4 love letters. I thought, hello. Anyway, briefly, one was from the Dean of Students when I was 18 years old, who fell madly, passionately in love with me and wrote me this letter that I've published in the book about how his life is ruined. We never did more than hold hands or exchange a kiss. How I'd ruined his life, and I'm not a crying man, Kate, but tears rolling down my eyes. So that was one letter. I have published that. The second was a beautiful Shakespearean sonnet from a professor at Nottingham University that I met on one of my examining trips, the most beautiful, beautifully written Shakespearean sonnet, which I've published. The third was from a racing yachtsman who described me as a racing sloop that came in and out of his life and went again. But the fourth one is the most interesting of all, in a packet with a Perish rubber band around them. My darling Kate, I can't, and it's on thin blue airmail letter. I can't live without you. I have sleepless days and nights. I'm drinking too much. I'm going to take you away from Alan. I'm going to take the children. We're going to run away together. Goes on like this for 4 impassioned pages. Signed, Alex. I have no idea who Alex is.
To this day.
To this day.
Isn't this worth investigating?
No, I have no idea. He obviously didn't make much of an impact on me.
That's incredible.
I have no idea who was going to give up his letter. And I have the letter. I have all 4 pages of the letter. Passionate. Love letter. I can't live with
that. Did you tear it up?
No, I kept it. I kept it, and I have the proof.
Wow.
Proof of it. But how amazing is it? And I've tried to think, and I have a very good memory, but nothing is.
But hang on, you told me you just recently had a proposal.
That was about 18 months ago. I have a very good friend. I've been on a couple of painting courses with him. He's very rich. He's English. He lives in Antwerp. He's got a house in London and a villa in Tuscany. And I have been 2 or 3 times to stay at the villa in Tuscany. He's very bright. He's got 3 degrees. He's passable. He's quite attractive. And we're sitting sipping Prosecco in Florence about 18 months ago. And he looks at me, he raises his glass and he says, what would you do if I asked you to marry me? I said, you're out of your mind. I wouldn't consider it for a moment. Are you mad? And his little face fell. Shame. And some of my friends have said, but he's rich. And I said, that's got nothing to do with it. I don't.
Do you think it's preposterous?
He's a bit boring, actually. He's a bit. You know, Gareth, when you have interviewed everybody from the Beatles to the Dalai Lama to Richard Dawkins to all the people you and I were involved with for so many years, it's got to be somebody pretty exceptional.
Inspiring.
Pretty exceptional.
So this year's travels.
Yes.
I saw a couple of things that you've never done before. You've got to tell me about Morocco this time last year. You've got to tell me about Tsarabanjina Island.
Oh, God, that was gorgeous.
That's in Madagascar, right?
Yeah. The Madagascar, the only, maybe the only reason to go to Madagascar is for the lemurs. Oh, I just so fell in love with the lemurs. And we went to, I was staying at a resort, first of all, at Nosy Bay at the top of the island. And there's like a wildlife reserve with rehabilitated lemurs, you know, like we have here, reserves,
and sanctuaries. Can you go in? And
went in, and these creatures, their soft, silky furs and their little velvet paws, and they come and sit on your shoulder. They are enchanting. I felt totally, totally in love with them. Absolutely beautiful little creatures. And then I went to Tsarabanjina Island, which is the ultimate desert island. Very, very, for a fistful of dollars, you can go there. But only about 8 chalets. It takes a 2.5-hour boat ride to get there from the mainland of Madagascar. And the story I remember best about it, you may remember many moons ago, I was lucky enough to be with a giant leatherhead turtle when she laid her eggs on a beach in Maputaland, which was one of the great spiritual, I use the term advisedly, experiences of my life. Anyway, the general manager of Tsarabanjina Island was an Italian marine biologist, and the greenback turtles lay there. And she saves about 6 every year because, you know, they don't make it back to the water. And when they're little, they're only the size of bath plugs, okay? So she gave me one and asked me, would I put it back in the sea? So, yes, I would put it back in the sea. So I took my little turtle, waded down to the shore on the surf, put him in, turned around, came straight back again. So I tried it again. Nope. This turtle did not want to go to sea. It was not an adventurous turtle. So eventually I hijacked in good Johannesburg fashion an Italian diver and said, go and take this turtle and take it out to the reef. So what became of my turtle? I don't
know. So
I don't know.
It's Tsarabanjina Island.
Yeah.
What's there?
Sand, sea, beauty, isolation, nothing.
Do you sometimes there, do you like isolation?
You go there. I mean, there were honeymoon. I was the only single person. Maybe that gives you an idea. There weren't many people there. So there were very rich honeymoon couples or very rich retirees.
Right.
And all of them at some stage or other said to me, come and join us. And I thought, no, you know, they're there. Anyway, I'd actually rather be on my own and watch. I'm a great observer of people. And
but do you like the isolation sometimes?
It was nice. It was, and I, you know, I had books. You know how I read. I still read about 5 books a week.
This is why, if you're at home, I don't think you're bored.
Never.
Despite your adventurous spirit, you don't need to be traveling the whole time.
No. As I say, my 2 girls came back. You know, one of their Flow Communications, one of their big clients is the Nelson Mandela Foundation. Of course, the lecture was this weekend in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And then they'd been traveling to and from Seattle the previous 2 weekends. So one of them said to me last night, I never want to travel again. I said, I know the feeling. I tried to get out of them, but couldn't because, you know, next year's lecture is on Mandela's birthday and it's the 100th birthday. And they have got a very, very big name, but they're sworn to secrecy and I can't. So fight. I'm on the invitation list. So yeah,
fight for an invite to that
fight
one.
For a ticket. I've tried, but can't get anything out of them.
Now, who do you still want to meet, speaking of big names? I mean, who would be interesting to you? You've met everybody.
Do you know, I've never been asked that question before. I still hold a bit of a flame for Shane Warne.
Really?
you know, that kind of bad boy Australian.
All right. Yeah.
I've written in the book, it's quite a funny thing. I've always been attracted to, I don't think looks have anything to do with it, but a certain type of man, power comes into it and intellect comes into it. I could never get on with the stupid. I could never get on with the stupid.
How do you know, though, if someone's...
I know immediately.
You know
Come
immediately.
On, you don't get to 83 without being able to read people very, very carefully. I'm occasionally wrong, but not often.
All right, so they have to be smart?
Very smart and knowledgeable and cultured and sexy and... A kind of power, and power has nothing to do with position or who you are. It's a kind of innate confidence, kind of power of knowing who you are, a confidence of knowing who you are.
Now, isn't that something that you only attain with experience? Because Socrates used to say, know thyself. And isn't that the point of life? And when you get to 83,
you get wiser.
Are you closer to knowing yourself?
Yeah, yes, I know myself. And I sometimes think, particularly having written the book and thinking of some of the letters and some of the things I've done, some of the things I shouldn't have done, how glad I am that I was innocent and knew nothing and just did it. Because if you had all that wisdom and foreknowledge, you'd never... You know, when I left my first husband for Alan, I'd only known Alan about 8 months. I packed... 2 suitcases, I had 1 small child in each hand, and I got on a plane for Ireland to go and live with Alan. I hardly knew him. I mean, think about it.
Brave.
I went to, well, was it brave?
It was just stupid. What I did.
It's just what I did.
But wouldn't you, I don't know, you say wisdom and you might not have done the things you'd done if you'd known as much as you know now. But you seem to me to be the sort of person who, if an adventure does come along, you'll hop on even now.
Oh, without doubt.
So I don't know that you would have changed your mind.
Without doubt. But I think, yeah, absolutely. Without doubt.
What I'm curious about, though, is when you get to know yourself better, you get to know your strengths and weaknesses better. So... You know now what you shouldn't attempt because you'll not have a good time and what you should always attempt.
What you're saying, Gareth, is actually you get more self-indulgent and you get more selfish. I don't bother with people I don't particularly resonate with or like. Why should I? Life's too short. I have really good friends, close friends, and I have thousands of acquaintances. I worked out. While I did the 20 years of Believe It or Not, I did over 4,000 interviews, plus teaching for 24 years at Wits. Think how many thousands of students went through my hands.
And luminaries.
As Alan used to say, I have misled hundreds of thousands of people in my day because I say things with such authority and such confidence that I...
All right, so the fishing trip on the houseboat in Jazini Dam, that's fun. Have you ever been on any other kind of hunting expedition? Are you into that sort of thing?
No, I don't do. I'm not against hunting because I know it fulfills quite a big economic role, but I don't like it and I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it myself. I save spiders from the bath, for God's sake.
Really?
I kill mosquitoes and flies, but I'm forever saving. But I once read when I was little in a Reader's Digest. Do you know how we used to read the, even you probably or your folks read the Reader's Digest, that if all the spiders in the world died out, so would the human race. So that fact
kept the spiders alive for you.
Commas. But I must just tell you one story. When I was writing the book, all sorts of things came back to me that I had forgotten. There's so many. When you think what I've done in my years and where I've lived and where I've travelled and the people I've seen. But I remembered, not quite Alex, but when I was at university, I had a boyfriend called Stephen Tite, T-I-T-E.
Mm-hmm.
And he's probably long dead now. And the only reason he was my boyfriend was he was a ward of the Worshipful Company of Goldsmiths in London, which is one of the 12 livery companies, or great livery companies from medieval days in London. He looked exactly like a curate out of a Jane Austen novel. He had buck teeth, a stammer. He wore a shiny, black suit, but he was a ward of the Worshipful. And I knew there was a banquet coming up. So I went with Stephen Tight to a banquet in the Guildhall with flickering candles and the beautiful, shiny, glossy wooden beams and the peers of the realm and the Lord Mayor in ermine and whatever. And we dined off gold plates and we drank out of gold goblets. And then I gave him up, and I later heard he married a girl called Constance from Cheltenham, which sounded much more suitable. But I mean, and interestingly enough, about I think in the '80s, maybe early '90s, the Guildhall, I mean, goes back forever, hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years, when they were doing some renovations or some building work, they found a 7,000-seater open-air Roman amphitheatre under the Guildhall.
That's incredible.
Where wild animals, circuses, give them bread and circuses, mm-hmm. and on a good day people were executed. So they were the very, very
busy
days.
There must be some energy on that spot.
Interesting.
Yeah.
How interesting is that?
Well, I thought about it. In our lifetime, they've found the actual bones of St. Peter, you know, under the Vatican. They've discovered things under the pyramids. All the things
that they've just discovered a new chamber.
Right. And all these things that we thought were as discovered as they could be, there's new stuff
every
time.
But I think Egypt keeps them all in wraps. literally. Mummies. You know, just wheels them out when they need. And I mean, I was just saying somebody last, in fact, to one of my grandsons last night, if you've got the money, go to Egypt now, because tourism is at its lowest ebb ever. You will be treated like royalty. I went to Russia first 3 days after 9/11. It was wonderful. There wasn't a tourist in sight. We were treated like royalty. It was, and I remember we flew BA and they lost our luggage, as you can understand. It was worldwide mayhem. And BA gave us little overnight kits, and there were little kits for ladies and little kits for men. And by the time they got to Allen, they'd run out of the men's kits. So he ran round in paper knickers for 3 days, which he said were very uncomfortable.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So where else have I climbed recently? Well, let me tell you about the St. Helena trip, because
it's on my list of things. All right, so St. Helena is this little island off of the coast of Africa. Well, it's quite far off the coast of Africa. It's halfway between South
America.
If you
go left from Windhoek straight into the South Atlantic, heading for South America, it's a dot in the middle of the ocean.
It's also the island that Napoleon died on.
Absolutely.
And it was a penal colony, especially for him.
And, well, I found out so much more.
There wasn't ever space for an airport.
You had
to go by ship.
And they're decommissioning the ship in February, because now the airline is working. I was on the inaugural Air Link flight. And they moved a mountain. They blew up a mountain to create the airstrip. 4 million tons of rock. And we flew with the two top pilots of Air Link, one being a woman, Tammy King. And you either make it or you don't. I mean, she said to me afterwards, "Were you frightened?" I said, "No, you know, I'm in the hands of professionals. Why should I be?"
Quite scary when the pilot asks you, "Were you frightened?"
But the governor, well, first of all, it's a British protectorate. There are very few left in the world. There's the Falklands, where I've been. Bloody godforsaken, dreadful.
Windy.
Dreadful place, except for the rockhopper penguins. Dreadful place. Bermuda, which is a bit better. St. Helena. I don't know if there are any more than three. But the islanders have been British since the 1600s, and they receive social grants from Britain. So the Brits do not like this, because they're taxed to supplement income, and there are only 4,500 people on the island, and they're called the Saints. Speak the most beautiful English, like 16th century English,
oh, really?
With a lilt. Nothing like West Indian English. Somebody said to me, pass the butter, please. Very English. You know, it's like a living laboratory because it's been a trade route where ships put in to stock and get fresh produce. But basically, it's been inured from the world. But let me tell you, you'll be interested in this. Napoleon was there, sent there after the Battle of Waterloo in 1815 and lived there for 6 years till he died. And I asked, because I siphoned off a guide who was a former history teacher and said, you know, this rumour that Napoleon was poisoned. He said, no, cancer of the stomach. And the sad thing, it's a small house, Napoleonic furniture furnished exactly as it was when he was there, very small. We're sitting in a studio about the size of quite a grand living room, I suppose. His lounge was half this size. His bathroom was about the size of a small bathroom or loo. And he had a leather bath, very narrow. He was a little man. He only took size 5 shoes. Some of his shoes were there. He sat in that bath the last few months of his life, day and night, as the servants poured hot water in. This was a man who had ruled half the world. Hubris. And you can't help but think of Ozymandias, look on my works, ye mighty,
and despair.
And you go, it goes back to, what's the point of having things?
Yeah.
Because everybody comes to this in the end. But one of the really fascinating things was 6,000 Boer prisoners of war were sent there after the Anglo-Boer-South African War. Between 1900 and 1902, 6,000 Boer prisoners of war were sent there. And we went to the Boer cemetery. Many of them were repatriated after the end of the war, but many died there. The youngest, 16, the oldest, 63. And the governor, wonderful, feisty lady, cockney kid like me, she and I got on like a house on fire, laid a wreath. There were only about 12 of us. It was pouring with rain, very poignant, green hillside, white tombstones coming down, a memorial at the end, and a lone bugler played the last post. And of course, I had tears in my eyes. One couldn't not. But she and I got on incredibly well and had quite a lot of fun together. Not at all like the starchy previous governors. But on the last day, there were only 4 South African journalists. There was BBC, there was CNN, there was ITV, there was Asian Press, there was all the world's media there because it was the first time a flight had
ever gone
in.
There, yeah.
And it was, you know, a big occasion for the island. Anyway, I was in a van with the BBC guy and a couple of the other guys. And as we drove back to the airport, it was drizzling with rain. And there was a very good view of the airstrip. So I stopped the van. I said to the BBC guy, I gave him my cell phone and said, come on, you're better at this than me. You take the camera. Mm-hmm. So he climbed out. I followed him up. And the roads are so narrow, 2 cars can't pass. And they're mainly vertical, they're hairpin bends. So the car coming uphill has right of way, so you have to pull over. Anyway, he's taking the shot. I'm standing in the middle of the road supervising him, and there's a very polite poop, poop behind me. I look round, it's the governor's Rolls Royce flying the flag, chauffeur sitting in front. So I tugged my forelock, went round to the back window, and she gave me a pretend Queen's wave, and the BBC guy said to me, you're the only woman I know that could stop the British government in its tracks.
What a story. Wow.
But an amazing place. And interesting because the island, it's only 5 miles by 3. I can't do kilometres because I didn't do the translation or whatever. It's a bastion, a fortress of rock from the outside. Once you go inside, it's like Lord of the Rings or Jurassic Park. There are green meadows and arum lilies and ancient trees. It's absolutely.
What an interesting place.
Beautiful.
And how poignant for you as an explorer and an adventurer to have in your 83rd year
the ability to go to St. Helena.
To somewhere where you haven't been and where most humans
would never
go.
I know. And I love Napoleon's house. I mean, the documents are there. And I just kept thinking, human hubris. You've ruled half the world and you end up
in a little leather
bath. You end up in a little leather bath. So it goes back to my philosophy, what we were talking about. What good are things? Spend my oldest grandson, who's 28, he says he's got a very good job here. He's a financial advisor. He says, I'm just like you, Granny. I'll never leave South Africa. I love South Africa, but I spend all my money on travel. So once a year he goes off with his mates. They spend every penny they've got travelling somewhere. And you know, I do find that with the media training I do, and I can tell you this, I mean, we do media training with the US State Department. I was in Cape Town on Monday doing some. Mm-hmm. So we're mixing with media training being how to show people how to be interviewed,
right,
in print, electronic media, etc. And I meet a lot of young people, brilliant, mainly black, feisty, intelligent, educated people who know exactly what's going on in the country, and they are the hope. I'm not talking about rural South Africa where people are very well informed. But you know, I mean, you're one of the ones that helped do it. People in our cities are incredibly well informed. Some of my best conversations are with Uber drivers. People know what's going.
They do.
People know what's going on. And this generation, I'm talking anything, I'm thinking of my own grandchildren, hold on, anything from 16 to 45, people are so sharp. And I always say, don't confuse educated people with smart people, because there are millions of smart people in South Africa who aren't educated, but they know what's going on.
Absolutely.
And that's the future of the country. And the other thing, at the risk of sounding like Pollyanna, our democracy is only 21 years old. What did you know when you were 21? Everything. Nothing. Nothing. And like being in Croatia now in September, they had that bloody dreadful war from 91 to 95. A million, Milosevic took out a million people. That's what, 20 years ago. I mean, millions of people died. Now they call it euphemistically the Homeland War. But you drive through villages where the houses are pockmarked with shells and whatever. And then you look at South Africa and you realise we actually have come a very long way. And what we still have, and as you know, Gareth, we fight for it, we still have a free press.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we hang on to it.
Very important.
But I do quite a lot of media training with other African countries, and they say, if I went on air tomorrow and said Zuma's a crook and a fool, I would sleep in my own bed, I hope, tomorrow night. Botswana, Namibia, Nigeria, Rwanda, Tanzania.
You couldn't do
that. No, it's you're going to be dead. You're going to be shot. I mean, it really is bad. And this from journalists. This isn't anecdotal This is literally from the horse's
mouth. All right,
mouth.
But then can I ask you something? Since you brought up media and you used to lecture in English, are you concerned sometimes about the quality of our information?
Totally,
Because the use of language has deteriorated in some respects. Journalists are not as interested in being florid.
But I think
140 characters on Twitter is not
enough.
I love
the tweet though that said, if I needed 280 characters, I would have reread Game of Thrones.
So what do you think of the quality of journalism?
I think they're incredibly smart, incredibly fast, but they're taught to do everything on their cell phones. So you take video clips, you edit, you take your audio clip, you edit, you file stuff, everything on your phone, and you do it quickly. So they're smart, they know what's going on, but I think time is enormous pressure against them. You know, we were saying this recently. even I think when you were a young journalist, there were still people who were particularly knowledgeable. There was still specialization. There was a finance guy. There was a consumer journalist. There was a this. There was a that. They're nearly all gone. I mean, newspaper, you know, is in freefall. People are being retrenched left, right and centre. You go to my daughter's company, Flo, their whole writing studio, they've got four ex-editors sitting there. They've got top journalists sitting there because... So it comes down to the juniorisation of the newsroom, but it comes down to money. When you first started broadcasting, news wasn't a commodity. It didn't have to be sold. News was something we were all entitled to.
Service.
Now, at news meetings, you get advertisers sitting in.
And clickbait and all that stuff.
Absolutely. So you're having to do everything fast, and they're cheap. A 25-year-old, again, what do you know when you're 25? The average age of journalists in this country is 25. Mainly women, which is an interesting fact. Other African countries, not so. Mainly women. They're cheap. Most of them are out of the industry by 30. They've either gone into PR or they've maybe gone into management. But there are still particularly very few women editors.
And the idea that all news has to be partisan, that there isn't, that there was always, we may not always have got it right, but you tried to be objective.
Absolutely.
You tried to represent both sides, not with an equivocation. In other words, if there was an obviously wrong...
No, you just got the two points of view. Absolutely.
But now it seems to me that people only follow the news sources that...
I really listen to the news.
That help to re-emphasize and for them give evidence to their side of the argument,
exactly,
regardless of whether it's true or not.
I did say, while we were on St. Helena, I said to the BBC guy, because, you know, a lot of the journalists were interested in talking to me, knowing what was it like in the old days at the BBC and ITV. And he said to me, Alistair Lightshaw, he's the head of the Africa desk for BBC. He said, Kate, there's still same integrity still applies. There's no such thing as a free lunch, that it's just as it was. He said, okay, there's more corporate, it's a bit more top heavy. But he said the ethics and the values are exactly the same. And if I want unbiased reporting, I will go to BBC World. I occasionally watch Sky News, but it's like a rabbit has got loose in Northampton and the whole country is in mourning for 5 days, and Brexit, Brexit, Brexit. CNN and Al Jazeera I watch, but I consume most of my news, I'm sure as you do, from the net. And New York Times I read every morning, just the headlines, and then choose what I want.
And I'm so pleased that there are still, even if they're battling, the New York Times, the BBC.
Washington Post just hanging in by its fingernails. Yeah.
But I think a lot of that stuff is going online, and a lot of smaller organizations that have definite principles about how they'll report the news will grow. And of course, there are still credible people.
And also, Gareth, I think the last census, 2011, I have a mind full of useless facts. 8 out of 10 South Africans still consume their news from the radio. The radio is incredibly important. Part of South African life and of African life. And with the terrible costs of data, you know, it's people use the radio all the time.
Now, are you really a Game of Thrones fan, and how much of a fan are you?
I have watched all seven series, 7 years of my life. I started by thinking, you know, I suffer from FOMO, fear of missing out. So I hate it. Have you watched The Handmaid's Tale? That is brilliant. Now,
everyone's talking about this Handmaid's Tale.
That's won the BAFTA, every BAFTA award. Anyway,
I
binge watch. Okay. So what I do, I finish work about 5, writing. Usually have a whiskey, then I do a crossword, Times or a Telegraph.
Most interesting word you've had to fill in a crossword lately?
Abso. ABSO, and I didn't know it. And it's punishment given to young offenders in England. Filled it in last night.
ABSO.
Never heard of it.
What kind of punishment would that be?
I have no idea. Huh. I haven't had time to look it up.
Wow. All right.
So then I will read for an hour, and then I will binge. I will binge watch. I'll watch up to 3 or 4 episodes. So I started Game of Thrones thinking, I hate sci-fi and I hate fantasy. Watched about 3 episodes, got totally and utterly hooked, and I've watched every single one. And I've sat on the Iron Throne.
Oh, yeah?
And I have, you know, mainly it's filmed in Northern Ireland. And I did a whole Game of Thrones. I was on an Irish trip with Irish Tourism, went to Winterfell, did the archery. Then we went to one of the castles. We had to ride a mountain bike. It was about 4 years ago, so I was about 79. I hadn't been on a bike for years. And the saddle was too high, and the pedals were too low, or vice versa. Anyway, I couldn't get on this bloody thing. Great big Irish in the full Game of Thrones outfit, leather jerkin, helmet, everything. He came up to me and he said, "Commit." So I committed, and off I.
How terrifying!
Off I row. But I've sat on the Iron Throne, and I've been to most of the. And I didn't because Dubrovnik was so crowded, but there are quite a few places there where they film. But most of it, Derry, a lot of it's filmed in Northern Ireland. I mean, it's actually reinvented, rejuvenated the. Economy of Northern Ireland really has. But I love it.
I'm doing some homework here. So Handmaid's Tales 1.
Yes.
Isn't it nice that we can binge these things now on our own time? We don't have to wait for them to come on the TV and record them and all that nonsense.
Wonderful. And I've watched some splendid series. And I've been a fan of Nordic Noir, the Scandi Noir from The Killing,
like
from the very first. I had a Swedish grandfather, remember. I've watched every Nordic Noir. And they're brilliant because they're not glamorous and whatever. The heroine usually has Asperger's and she wears dirty jumpers and she takes her jumper off in the office and she's got an awful old bra on. And it's real people and real characters, proper characters and diabolically clever plots. Diabolically clever plots. But I just finished the latest BBC one, which they're debating whether to. It only came out, I think, last week, and I binge-watched it over the weekend because it's such awful weather, called The Last Post. And I thought to myself how Alan would have loved it being in the British Army. It's about Aden in the 1960s and an army post there and how the terrorist stroke freedom fighters were called tribal insurgents. But, I mean, it was a dirty, nasty war going on and how the British tried to cover it up and sanitize it and whatever. But very, very well done. Very well done. And playing lots of lovely 60s music too.
What do you make of all this resurgent sort of alpha male political nonsense with Trump and Putin and Zuma and, you know, these sort
Shame.
Of these men who, yeah, they're kind of men of a bygone era almost because they're these.
They'll self-implode. I don't think Putin will. I think Putin's too clever, but I think Trump will self-implode it because I think Trump is stupid. I actually don't think he is bright. I mean, Putin is very, very bright. You know, I was in a village in Russia some years ago and our guide was an ex-Afghan vet. He'd been fighting with and for the Russians in Afghanistan. He spoke very good English in his 70s. And I got him away from the group and I said to him, "What do you think of Putin?" And he said, "You know, I've been around for a long time." And then he paused and he said, "I smell a Stalin."
Hmm.
And that to me, what a brilliant, brilliant remark. I smelled Stalin. And then we had a young history professor on a boat. We were doing the Russian waterways from St. Petersburg to Moscow, wonderful trip. And we had a young, very outspoken history professor. And he said to us as a lecturer, he said, you know, He believes there is something in the Russian psyche that demands a strong, terrible, powerful leader. And he cited Ivan the Terrible, the Tsar, Stalin. And he says Putin fulfills that role. And you've got people in, everywhere you go in the world, you've got people in Russia wishing for the good old days of Stalin because they knew they'd get their pension, have their 2-week holiday. You get the old people in Croatia that was once Yugoslavia, is now 6 different countries saying, well, things were bad, but you get people here, same thing, at least we had X, Y, and Z. It's this nostalgia for a past that didn't really exist.
Yeah.
Because you're only remembering the good stuff.
And I know you're very optimistic about what we're doing here and where we're headed, even though there's a lot of indication that we've made mistakes.
Oh, totally. 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 The more I travel, Gareth, and I like Shakespeare's Puck, I've girdled the world now so many times. There is no country in the world as good as South Africa. And I say that from the heart. There is nowhere else I would choose to live. Maybe if my family were living somewhere else, maybe that would cast a different light on things. But I come back and I mean, okay, potholes, no water, whatever. But you drive from Johannesburg to Durban, our provincial roads are stunning. They're in excellent condition. I know we're paying, we should be paying, tolls, whatever. But we have wonderful weather. We have, in Johannesburg. And as you know, I don't know if you remember, I'm not a Cape Town fan. Mm-hmm. I quite like Cape Town. But somebody said, I was in Cape Town on Monday, last Monday. Somebody said to me, you're all such bad drivers in Johannesburg. I said, we are brilliant drivers. If we weren't, we'd be dead. Whereas Cape Town drivers are dreadful. Dreadful.
Now, look, we're all excited about the book. You said it's April next year.
Yeah. And I can give you the title. Mm-hmm. Yes, really.
That's the title?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yes, really.
I'm very excited about this book. Yes. I'm sure lots of us will be. Kate, thanks for the visit.
Pleasure.
Always lovely to see you. We could have carried on talking for another half hour. I wouldn't have got bored if it was 3.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Kate Turkington, everybody.
This is CliffCentral.com.